Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of What the How? You know, one of the things that strikes me about the history of World War II is the Holocaust and the fact that many of those who were caught up in that, if they survived, they're vanishing. Age. And we've been lucky enough to find two people in their 90s who experienced that nightmare. And they're here along with two others to talk about it as we discuss a brand new documentary.
My name is Fred Zaidman.
And your name?
Adela Mannheimer.
Donna?
Donna Cantor.
And?
David Linga.
Now, these are four very interesting people, and they're interesting because they're all involved in a documentary that Donna has produced. And that documentary has a name. What's the name, Donna?
The Presence of Their Absence.
And the purpose of the documentary is?
It's to follow a man seeking his roots in the ashes of the Holocaust.
All right, and Fred is that man. And Fred, why don't you sort of tell me about this journey?
This journey began about 7 years ago. After my parents both passed away, I decided to do my genealogy search to see how far I can get building a family tree, which I thought was a twig. And I say a twig because my father lost his whole family, three brothers, two sisters, his parents. They were all gone. He never talked about them.
All died in the Holocaust.
They were all murdered in the Holocaust. Yes, in Treblinka and in Auschwitz.
And your parents never talked about it, so it was very hard for you to get information?
It was hard for me in the sense that I didn't have the courage to ask them. Because
and you festered this feeling for a long period of time?
Probably for the last 10 years of their life.
When did they pass away?
They passed away in 2012, 5 weeks apart.
5 weeks apart. They had lived together. They had been married for how long?
They have been married since 1945.
And the interesting thing about that is they got married after they got released from the camp, just a matter of months, really, within the same year.
That's correct.
They met after they got released.
They were liberated in April 1945, and they married on August 25th, 1945.
Is that because back then there were people that came out of the camps who survived, who wanted to have children, wanted to repopulate, wanted to regrow the Jewish community?
Well, yes, that's a part of it. And the other part is that they had no family to go home to.
How'd you go about doing this? I mean, if I wanted to go back and find out something about the people in my past, I can't get too far back behind my grandparents and maybe great-grandparents, because it's just a big thing trying to get your genealogy.
Well, it is, but it's undaunting at first. I didn't think I was going to get anything. Honestly, if I could find a cousin or an uncle, I would have been thrilled. I really didn't expect to find anybody, but I did. And one discovery led to another discovery.
So take us through a couple of bullet points of what you found. First, you get over there and you do what?
In Poland?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, but it started before that.
Okay. Where did it start?
Okay, well, it started with my personal search on the internet, Ancestry.com, Genie.com, all the genealogy sites.
Did that become an obsession?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Became I'm still obsessed with it.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm driven.
Where did it go from there?
From there, I was asked to do the documentary from Donna Cantor, and from there, everything really took off.
So you take off, you go overseas, you go to the other world, and what emotions drive you through this?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure it was emotions. I was just driven to do it. It's something like, you're born to do something, just like flowers is
good. Yeah, but there is motivation. There is motivation that you feel when you do something. For instance,
yes,
let me give you an example. I feel like I don't have any hobbies. So I felt like I needed to pick up a couple of hobbies. So I decided to grab a sketchbook and watercolors. And my kids said, well, start with one object. So I saw a rose, and I painted the rose. I sketched it, and then I painted it. Now I feel driven to learn more about how to do watercolors, so I've actually found an art teacher to teach me for this journey. when you go on a journey, whatever it might be, there is something that drives that. There is emotion that drives that, right?
Yes, there is an emotion. And I think I was motivated to find out what my parents, my grandparents look like. I have no idea. There's no photos. And when my father did tell me that he had two sisters and three brothers, and that really intrigued me, and I just had to know. I just wanted to know what they looked like. I wanted to know how old they were, what they did, and so on.
Did you find people that knew them?
I didn't find anybody that knew them, but when I was in Radomsko, Poland, where they originally were from, we went into one of the city hall records, and they were able to find the birth certificate of my aunts and my uncles, as well as the marriage certificate of my grandparents.
But you still don't know what they look like.
I still don't know what they look like.
So you get to the house, you get to the house of your dad, and it's all torn down.
It's just gone. It's just a parking lot.
And that angered you?
Very much. It angered me.
What'd you do?
I swore, just not to anybody in particular, just at the circumstances. I needed to do something. I couldn't go there and not leave a calling card.
So, you did, and that calling card was almost a little vandalism, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was vandalism. Look, I didn't really care. I didn't care.
What'd you do?
I didn't care if I was arrested or not. I took my key. No, I didn't. It wasn't a key. It was a rock I found in the parking lot. And I went to this kiosk, which was like a mailbox. It was a metal container in which the Red Cross set up, and people put clothes in it. I wrote down my family's name. I engraved it on that box, and then I wrote down 1939. That's the only thing that came to my head. I didn't know what else to write. So I was saying, we came back. Somebody came back from my family. It was me. I said, we're back, and here's the name, and this is the year it all started.
We saw you filmed in a cemetery where you find your great-grandparents, where they're laid to rest. And I remember the words, I'm here, or something to that effect, like you were talking to great-grandma.
Yes, absolutely. I was talking to them.
What'd you say?
I said, your great-grandson is here.
How'd that feel?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. I was surprised in that I wasn't upset. I wasn't angry or anything when I was there. I was rather serene and very very loose and happy to be with my great-grandparents.
They did not die during the Holocaust.
No, that was the big difference. They led a full life, and they died. They passed away. They didn't know what was going to happen with their children. They had no idea.
Donna, when you produced this documentary, the purpose of it was to document one man's life and one man's journey. And you learned things through that process as well. What did you learn?
Well, you know, to take your analogy, to find the rose and paint the rose properly, you need helpers. You have to find a way. And I think it's so large, the undertaking, that you have to figure out, if for anyone who's searching for family, you either have to know, where did the family end up? How did they die? Where did they die, perhaps? To trace backwards where they came from. And for me, the story of a man searching for his roots was so compelling. When I heard Fred's story, it was so moving to me, because we had always heard the stories of survivors. And not that recently. Rather more recently is when we started to hear the stories. Only until the 80s was the Holocaust really spoken about. And I noticed you use the Schindler's clip. And that's one example in one time when we really started to hear stories emerge. But we never really heard the stories of the children, the ones who didn't hear the stories from their parents, or heard too much, or heard the emotional part of the story, but not the facts. So I always wondered, what was that experience like for the children of survivors? And so to go with Fred, to have him find those places that were beautiful in his mind and then proved to be, and the places that were completely destroyed, it was a tremendous experience for me to see his him go through that, and I thought that was a good story.
I would imagine that there are moments that are heartwarming, and I imagine there are moments that are heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're going into the past, into a time that was very difficult, and both Adela and David know those times because they were there. So let me start with David, and take us back to the 1940s. You're, 17 years old, and what happens? You end up in a concentration camp, right?
Yes. I was first thrown into the ghetto of Łódź. Prior to this, we spent 2 years in the ghetto of the city of Stryków, which is a small town 18 kilometers south of the city of Łódź. My father had a tannery there. We were forced to produce leather and fur and clothing for the German army. They confiscated our factory, but they let us live because they needed my dad to put in motion the enterprise and to work for the German Reich. We were then thrown into the Łódź ghetto after a selection. After 2 years, they dissolved the ghetto in Stryków. They made a selection. The able-bodied people that they consider able-bodied were shown to the right with a thumb, and the ones that they were about to eliminate, they were shown to the left, to go to the left. I, my mother, my younger brother, 4 years younger than myself, my grandma, we were sent to the ghetto in Łódź, and my dad was sent with the men to a slave labor camp in Poznań Kutno.
So part of your family was sent to the right.
Right.
Part of your family was sent to the left.
Absolutely. And so consequently, we wound up in the ghetto of Łódź. In 1942, the ghetto of Łódź was fully set up. There were towers, there were barbed wire fences, there were electrified fences, there were soldiers, guards with dogs. There was no way to escape. And so we were subject to very hard labor. I was at that time about 14 years old, and I was working in a clothing factory. My mom had to work in a different kind of factory, produce some kind of baskets and so forth, whatever that was. Everybody had to be employed if you wanted to eat. Everything was rationed. We were totally starved in the ghetto. It was a deliberate policy to starve the population. It was part of their plan. And so after in 1942, it was a big selection. And again, I was separated from the people that were very close to my heart and close to me. My mom, my brother was taken away and killed. I was remained in the ghetto, and I was working until 1944. And in 1944, the ghetto was dissolved, and I was taken to Auschwitz. And in Auschwitz, I surreptitiously escaped through cunning, through savvy, through sheer luck, and I was sent to Germany proper, and I wound up in Dachau. And in Dachau, they sent me to a sub-camp in Kaufering. And in Kaufering, we were slaves. We were working on bombed-out railroad tracks in Germany. We were mixing cement waist-deep. We were just totally eviscerated. And the people were dying by the dozens every single day. I went to sleep in the barracks with live people. When I woke up, I was the only one survived. The one to the left, the one to the right is dead. So this is the subject of my experience there in a nutshell. And then obviously, when towards the war's end in 1944, we were sent from the south of Germany to the north to Bergen-Belsen. And on the way, we had to stop in a thick forest. We were attacked by American forces, and we were machine gunned because they thought that we were a military train, and we were machine gunned. Very many people, hundreds of them, of our prisoners died. And those that jumped over into the forest and saved themselves, they survived. And eventually, we wound up on a farm, in a German farm, and for several days that they hid us out. And we were then liberated by the 6th Army of the United States.
You met your wife not long after that?
Yes.
And she was also somebody who
was a Holocaust survivor from Czechoslovakia.
And that happened to quite a few people, didn't it? Where people who were survivors met after being released, got married, and the purpose of which was to, hey, we've got to replace what we lost.
Absolutely. We found ourselves very much alone in the world. I did not know that my father survived. I found that out much later. And my wife-to-be, she also felt that she was the only one of her entire family left alone. We were two young people. I was close to 18 at that time when the war ended. I happened to have met her in a transit camp. She was a gorgeous, beautiful young woman, of course. We fell in love, and we decided to marry after 3 weeks courtship.
Wow, 3 weeks. And it lasted how long?
3 weeks. It lasted 55 years. Yeah,
there's a story right there, isn't there?
Oh, my God, yes. Yes.
You miss her?
Oh, my God, do I miss her. She was everything for me. She was everything for my entire family.
When did you lose her?
I lost her very tragically in 2000 in a tragic car accident. It was a police pursuit, and the criminal ran into her broadside and killed her instantly. She was at that time 77 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
That was a big tragedy.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I survived, and I have a thriving family now. I have three beautiful daughters with their husbands, which are like sons to me. I have seven grandchildren. Five great-grandchildren, the sixth one on the way. So I'm a very happy man at this point.
And you're 91 years old. Or yes. I should say 91 years young, right?
Yeah.
Donna?
He was the tailor to the stars.
Yes, I was.
Which means what?
Well, which means that I was associated with the Eric Rosen Company in Beverly Hills for many years, for 15 years. We were the place to go to in terms of styles and fashion. We were working for the movie industry and for all the people in it, and we were creating tremendous, beautiful wardrobes and costumes for the movie industry, and I got to know all the people that were meaningful to that industry, including the actors, actresses, producers, directors, everyone that is anyone. And it was a very gratifying experience. I built my life in America. I got later to real estate, and I was quite successful at it. And out of the ashes of the Holocaust, I was able to turn my life around. I was able to put the horrors in somewhat behind me, not fully, obviously, but I just managed to put them under the rug, as it were. But they're always there. Those experiences never cease to be with me. But I was able to realize that I have only one life, like everyone else, and I have to live my life to the fullest. And I was able, had the strength of character and the moral strength to pursue my life in a meaningful way and create a successful family. And today I'm speaking to wide audiences at the Museum of the Holocaust, Los Angeles, to the Museum of Tolerance in Beverly Hills, and to audiences statewide, citywide. I'm very gratified that I can bring my message of the Holocaust to audiences that are totally ignorant about it. And I am able to enlighten young people and older people alike about the recent history that was so horrendous. And unfortunately, of all this that transpired, we're seeing certain parallels happening in the world today, and it is making me very, very anxious. Mm. Thank you.
Adela, you are an amazing woman. You're 98 years young, and what a life you've had. And I want you to tell us your story as well, because I know that you were also a teenager at the time when you ended up becoming a concentration camp occupant.
Yeah. Okay. When Hitler came in to my city, the first thing what I saw, I was living close to the temple, to the Jewish, that is burning. So they put some horses in the temple, and my mother was 50 years old, and she said to me, "I can see that we will be separated." And I looked at her, I was one child. And I looked at her and I said, why we be separated? Because you're gonna be in probably in a concentration camp, and I will be different. I will go probably to Auschwitz. We already knew it was. So she said to me, remember, that's two, when somebody hits you, don't hit back, because two wrong don't make a right one. And I look again to her and I said, how this could be? Even I was very naive, and in Poland, we couldn't have big education because we were Jewish. We could just finish the elementary school and nothing. So I went to a second city, and I took private lessons for bookkeeping. But that was nothing to do with my life. So I'm going back to talk short my story. When I was in Greenberg Schlesien, and that was belonged to Auschwitz, of course, I was working at night time very hard, and we were very, very limited with food, hardly two slices bread, a little soup, too hard to find a potato, and we put out the potatoes to have for later for a salad, and that was like 4.5 years. And we were very, very, you know, one time I have a bug in my ear, was ringing, and I couldn't work. And they said, I don't want to work, and they hit me all the time. And I was very, very with no hope, okay. But what I thank God for my life is my father. My father was, when he was 4 years old, an orphan. And he grew up when he was a tailor, like our friends told us. He was working very hard, and he decided to be a charitable person to collect money for all poor people, like Bikur Holim and all kind of Knusses Kalom. This is a Jewish organizations. And for this reason, I think I am here to talk about it.
You told me a story about walking a very, very long distance.
Yeah.
Tell me that
story.
The
1945.
Okay.
They decided to run away from Greenberg.
Greenberg being a concentration camp.
And we decided to walk us and to get rid of us by shooting every day at a few girls on the way. And I was always a victim to look this. And one day I couldn't walk anymore. And because I'm little, I walk in a doghouse, and hiding in this doghouse.
Wait. You hid in a doghouse? A little doghouse? Oh, my goodness.
I was there, and that was the daytime. So this Nazi had a little golden gun.
A little golden gun?
Okay. So he cut me, and he said in German, you verfluchte Jude, wenn du ausreißen willst, warum in der Hellen Tag?
Okay, can we translate that real quick?
Okay. If you want to run away, why did you do in daytime to lower my prestige?
To lower his prestige.
Yeah. But I said, Shema Israel. and I'm waiting for him to shoot, because in my eyes, he shoot 18 geros, my friend, and I was waiting, and he said, go. So I went for the last line. We were walking in the dead marsh, and my belonging was a little pillow, and I dropped it, and I see he's coming with the pillow, and I said, Shema Israel, he's gonna shot me now. He gave me this pillow.
And he didn't shoot you. And Shema Israel is a prayer.
I'm sitting here.
Right.
So I make a short story. I was going to tell you about my husband. My husband was going to be shot, and he decided to jump from a running truck, because they were going to be shot next. But all the other guys was cutting the veins, and he decided to jump. And when he jumped, they shot him in the back, and he had 7 ribs. After 5 surgeries, 7 ribs out, so he couldn't breathe. So he was in a sanatorium. He wants me to leave me alone, because I came out okay and he not. And I said, no way. It's Naomi and Ruth. It's the history. Whatever will be, I could be in the same situation. And after this, he had 5 surgeries and came out that's a little better, and I married him after 5 years being engaged with the parents.
And how long were you married?
I was married from 47 till 84. He passed away. Mm. Yeah. I was the bread giver. I was the nurse. I was the cleaner, the cook, everything. So my life was very, very bad. But now I raised 2 wonderful children. They are very famous in book writing, in top photographers, and journalists, and everything.
And so as David said, from the ashes came something good.
Yeah, I have 6 wonderful grandchildren. They are doctors, movie makers, and everything, you name it.
And so the important story there really is that you survived, and because you survived, you had children, and your children have been very successful contributors to society. Donna?
Well, she said something to me.
The mic, please.
What I really liked was that her father gave her the strength. You started to say that your father, because he saw the goodness in all humans, that gave you the strength to be who you are.
I need to sort of bring this to a conclusion.
This is the credit.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I wanted to kind of bring this to a conclusion, but I want Fred to sort of sum up something for us here, and I want to get back to the documentary. And what I want to ask you is, as you look at David and Adela, it's almost like you're looking at your folks, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because they went through this.
I know them since 14 years.
Oh, you've known each other a long time.
7 years.
So I adopted him as my stepson. And my son adopted him as a stepbrother.
But the question I have for you is, when you listen to their stories, these could be your mom and dad.
Well, absolutely. And I consider all Holocaust survivors a member of my family.
David.
No, I was commenting on what he said, is that his need for family continues. I think that loss was profound.
I think it was. I want to, one more time, just tell everybody about the documentary, what it's called, where people can see it, Donna.
The Presence of Their Absence. We are showing it in festivals, and we're beginning the process with theaters, but right now it's on iTunes, Amazon Prime, and if you have Charter, Cox, or the Spectrum cable channels, you can find it online now, which is great, and download it.
On a personal note, I've known Donna for a very long time. Donna has been a very successful documentarian. She did one a long time ago on I Love Lucy, as I recall.
Yes.
And she and I were on a board of governors of the Television Academy here in Hollywood. And her dad's name was Hal. So we have a lot in common. And Hal was a great writer himself. And so Hal Cantor gave us Donna Cantor. And Donna Cantor gave us this documentary. Well, thanks again to the guest. And if you haven't subscribed already, yeah, please do. I mean, you know, what the hell, right? Best. See you later. Bye.